Buenos dias, everybody. I'm happy to be here. My name is Hjördís Atladóttir, and I'm a medical doctor and an epidemiologist from Denmark. I've spent quite some time looking at the association between maternal immune activation and autism using epidemiological designs. I think when you look at this literature, it's quite overwhelming. So in the next few minutes, I want to give you an overview. I don't have any brand new results, but I hope that you get something out of it anyway. As I see it, there are two primary hypotheses when you look at maternal immune activation. The first is something we've looked quite a lot at. That's the maternal infection during pregnancy. And here we often look at viral infection and we often look at influenza. The second theory is the placental fetal antibody transfer theory, and that revolves around antibodies in the blood of the mother passing on to the fetus and possibly do harm. I'm going to talk about the maternal infection during pregnancy, that theory first. Now, you can't really touch upon this theory without talking about the mouse models. The basis for this theory is something that has been looked in mouse models. Paul Patterson and his team at the Patterson Lab have done quite a lot of this research, but also other people have been involved and done studies. If you want a great review on the topic, you should read this one, which I recommend. Also, Paul Patterson has written a book which is very easy to read, and I also recommend that. Now, how do they do the mouse studies? Basically, they just take the pregnant mouse, and then they either contaminate it with the influenza virus, or they inject the poly-IC to imitate a viral immune response, or they inject LPS to imitate a bacterial immune response. Then the pregnant mouse, in time, gives birth, and then they look at the mouse baby. They look at behavioral abnormalities. So they've created this model. So they look at all triads of the autism spectrum. So when they look at social interaction, they look at how the mouse socially interacts with the other mice. When they look at stereotype repetitive behavior, they look at things like time spent self-grooming. And when they look at language, they've created a way to measure ultrasonic vocalization within the mouse, or between the mice. And when they contaminate the mother or create an immune response in the pregnant mouse, they actually see behavior abnormalities in the offspring. Also, they've looked at neuropathology, and they, among other things, they see deficiencies in the Purkinje fibers in the cerebellum, which is also something we see in humans with autism spectrum disorder. And lastly, they also have looked at scans of the brain, and they see abnormalities here. The mechanism behind this is not fully understood, but at least we know that it's not infection of the fetus. They don't find virus or bacteria in the fetus. It seems as though it's the maternal immune activation that is enough. We know that IL-6 or interleukin-6 is quite important, and at least they know that if they block IL-6 from being produced, they also can prevent the behavioral abnormalities. This is very interesting. What they can see is that the placenta also produces more cytokines when the mother has an active immune system, and they've also found cytokine production in the fetal brain, so the fetus is directly involved as well. I think future perspectives for the mouse studies is that they want to improve the mouse models. They want to try to differentiate between autism spectrum symptoms and schizophrenia symptoms. Also, it would be nice to implement monkey models, which would be easier to interpret the behavior. Gene-environment interactions are of course, always relevant. And in time, in the future, therapeutic interventions would be good to look at. Now, we want to look at people. So we can't do randomized trials on people. That would be very unethical. So when we look at people, we have to do observational studies. The first studies appeared in the 70s. Here, Chela reported an increased risk of autism if the mother had, if the child had congenital rubella. And in 1979, there was a study which reported a fourfold increased risk of autism if the mother had influenza during pregnancy. And here they compare to siblings. Now, we wanted to do this, something similar in Denmark. So why in Denmark? That's because we have really good chances of doing great or good epidemiology in Denmark. All Danes have a 10-digit number which they get at birth, and it's used in all official registrations. So when we go to school, when we contact health medical services, when we get a job and we pay taxes, we always use the same number. And we have great registries in Denmark. We register almost everything. So we can do nationwide studies. The first study we did in Denmark was we wanted to look at season variation in the birth of children with autism. The theory was that if influenza during pregnancy or during first trimester, which is the vulnerable time, if that is a risk factor for autism, then we maybe should see more children with autism being born late summer. Unfortunately, when we did this, we found no season variation. As you can see, the line is fluctuating around 1 from 0.95 to 1.05, so we see no season variation. So we went on, and here we used the hospital registers to find women that had been admitted to hospital due to infection during the pregnancy. This was a huge study. We included 1.6 million women, or 1.6 million kids, and over 10,000 of these children had autism. And again, the woman had to be hospitalized with an infection in order to be exposed in our study. And this is what we found. When we look at the whole pregnancy, we didn't find any association between any kind of infection and autism. We tried to look at viral infection in particular, and also when we looked at the whole pregnancy, we didn't find any association. So we went on and we stratified by trimesters. When was the woman hospitalized? And when we did this, we found a threefold increased risk of autism if the woman had been hospitalized due to a viral infection during the first trimester. This was quite interesting and supports the findings from the animal studies. But, and I think this is quite important to keep in mind, that when we look at the numbers, what's the basis behind these numbers? So we only had 9 kids with autism spectrum disorder that had a mother that had been admitted due to viral infection in the pregnancy. And only 6 of these women were admitted during the first trimester. So all in all, 6 kids are the basis for this threefold increased risk. So we went on, and now we thought, okay, maybe hospitalization isn't the best way to measure exposure, because most women with a viral infection, they just stay home. They don't come in contact with hospital. So here we use the Danish National Birth Cohort. It's a cohort of 100,000 women, and 1,000 of these had a child on the autism spectrum. 340 had infantile autism. And these women, they've answered questionnaires, very extensive questionnaires, in gestational weeks 17, 32, and then 6 months after birth. And among other things, they were asked about whether or not they had an infection during pregnancy. And they were asked about specific infections. And this is what we found. When we looked at influenza, we found no increased risk of autism. However, we found just about twofold increased risk of infantile autism if the woman answered yes to have had influenza during the pregnancy. And again, if you look at the numbers, underlined in red, there are only 7 kids that had infantile autism that also had a mother that answered yes to have had influenza. So the numbers aren't big, even though these are huge studies. And we also looked at fever. The woman was asked whether or not she had fever during the pregnancy, and we found a threefold increased risk of infantile autism again if the woman had a fever for a week or longer. And again, if you look at the numbers, only 14 kids with infantile autism had a woman that answered yes to this. So I really want to talk to you about scientific value versus clinical value. So what we're finding, it's very interesting, and we do find the statistically significant increased risks, and they do support the animal theories. So I think there's something here we should look more at. But at least when you're interpreting the results and when it gets into the media, it's important to have the absolute numbers also. So we had 800 women that said yes to have had influenza. Only 8 of these had a child with infantile autism, and similar numbers for fever. So it's important to also say that 99% of women that are exposed to this do not have a child with autism. I think when the relative risks hit the media, then the pregnant woman can easily become afraid, and it's important to also communicate the absolute numbers. Now, we're not the only ones that have done this, studies on this subject. The CHARGE study, which you've heard a lot about from the previous speakers, they've also done a study on this. This was a population-based study with 500 kids with autism and 160 kids with developmental delay. So they had a comparison outcome group, which is a quite nice detail. And they had 400 kids which were typically developed. Now, the CHARGE study had a comparison outcome group, which I regret we didn't do in our study. Also, they had other elegant details, such as vaccination status for the woman and also consumption of antipyretic medication. In the CHARGE study, they didn't find a statistically significant increased risk for autism after influenza. No, they didn't look at infantile autism specifically, they only looked at the spectrum. So this fits quite well to what we also found. We also did not find an increased risk for the spectrum when we had our questionnaires. The CHARGE study found a twofold increased risk for autism spectrum disorder after episodes of fever. And this also fits very well to what we found in the Danish studies. However, we see here that the finding isn't autism-specific. There's also an increased risk of developmental delay if the woman had fever during pregnancy. Now, this nice detail of whether or not she took medication to lower the temperature, if you see if she did that, the odds ratio suddenly is 1.3, so the odds ratio is lower if she took antipyretic medication. So that's a nice detail. Also, a very important finding, I think, from this study is the vaccination message. Here we find that women that have children with autism were more likely to be vaccinated. So based on this, we can say that influenza vaccination doesn't seem to be a risk factor for autism. And I also think that's an important message to get out there to the women. So future perspectives. I think both the Danish studies and the CHARGE study, we have some problems in misclassification of the exposure. When we did the Danish study, less than 1% of the women answered yes to have had influenza. Also, when we compared it to the hospital registers, there were 27 women within our study group that were admitted to hospital due to influenza, so they got the diagnosis influenza. But only 2 of these said yes when they were asked. So either they didn't know what they were admitted for or they didn't remember. So we have some kind of misclassification. So it would be really nice to get verified influenza exposure cases. Also, and this is something we can do in Denmark, is that do a study on the influenza vaccination to see if that is a protective factor for autism. Now, the other theory I want to talk to you about is the antibody transfer theory. If you want to know more about this, then I urge you to read this abstract. Now, this review by Elizabeth Fox, it's very good. And also, there's a nice chapter in this book by Andrew Zimmerman. During pregnancy, the fetus gets antibodies from the mother. And this is quite natural, and it's supposed to happen. And these antibodies protect the fetus from infections in early life. They get the antibodies through the placenta from the blood. Also, during certain times of the pregnancy, they get it by swallowing the amniotic fluid, and then postnatally they get it through the mother's milk. And these antibodies are good, essentially, but could there be any harmful antibodies? But quite a lot of people that have looked at this, and what they've done is that they've taken antibodies or blood from mothers to children with autism. And then they've seen if these antibodies react to fetal brain. And actually, they do. So antibodies from women that have children with autism react to both rodent fetal brain, monkey fetal brain, and human fetal brain. And if they take blood or antibodies from women that have typically developed children, they don't see the same reaction. Also, they've also done mouse studies here, the same way they did with the infection studies. And here they take antibodies from mothers with children with autism and inject it into the pregnant mouse. And then they see both behavioral deficiencies in the offspring of the mouse. And one study has done this with monkeys as well, and also seed behavioral abnormalities. When they take antibodies from mothers to typically developed children and inject that into the pregnant mouse, they don't see behavioral abnormalities. So I think future perspectives here, or at least what they write, is that they want to further develop the mouse model. It's important also to see which specific antigens within the fetal brain that reacts to the antibodies, and also see how these antigens affect the brain development. So there's much to do. Now again, we can't randomize people, and we can't do mouse similar studies on people, so we have to use the epidemiology, we have to use observational studies, and when we do this, at least most epidemiologists have decided to use autoimmune disease as a proxy for high antibody concentration during pregnancy. We did this in Denmark in 2009, and we looked at the family history of autoimmune diseases and the risk for autism. This was also a large study with 700,000 kids, and 3,000 had autism. And what we found was a 70% increased risk for autism if the mother had arthritis. And this is actually a replication of a finding from Comey and colleagues back in 1999. Also, we found an increased risk, a threefold increased risk of autism if the mother had celiac disease. And this is a finding that hasn't been reported elsewhere. And also, we found an increased risk of autism if the mother had type 1 diabetes. But we also found an increased risk if the father had type 1 diabetes, so this is probably more or less a genetic predisposition. Now here it's important to look at the positive finding, but it's also important to look at the negative findings. So we are looking at many autoimmune diseases, and we find a few positive findings. But the fact that we don't see an increased risk after all autoimmune diseases points towards that either these are coincidental findings, or there are some very specific antibodies involved. So at least not all autoimmune diseases in the mother are risk factors for autism. Now, we are not the only one that have done this. A very recent study from Sweden has done almost exactly the same we did, but with the Swedish data. They found an increased risk for autism if the mother had diabetes, systemic lupus, myasthenia gravis, or rheumatic fever. And again, they looked at multiple diseases, and they found an increased risk for some, but not all. So I think future perspectives on this, in the epidemiological sense, is that I think we've had enough of the studies where we look at multiple diseases. I think we have to try to focus our hypotheses and try to stratify our analysis on disease severity. So maybe look at whether or not the woman was hospitalized during pregnancy, did she need medication, what kind of medication, maybe send out questionnaires to ask how severe the disease was during the pregnancy. So try to be more specific. So where do we stand? We know that animal studies and biomarker studies strongly suggest an association between maternal immune activation and autism. The epidemiological studies strongly support these hypotheses, but they are a little bit more inconclusive, and I think we need to be more specific when we do the epidemiological studies. But no matter what, I think this is a hypothesis that needs and deserves to be investigated further. If you want to do epidemiological studies on this subject, I think we should try to be more specific when we formulate the hypothesis, try to avoid multiple comparisons, try to include detailed stratified analyses. I think we should think about how we define the outcome groups, maybe instead of using the whole spectrum, then try to use just infantile autism or some more specific subgroup of the spectrum. If we could include some genetic variation in that, that would be great. Also think about that if we can, then we should use comparison outcome groups to see if the results we get are autism specific, or if it's something that applies to many neurodevelopmental disorders. And also, always, when you interpret the results, think about the scientific value versus the clinical value. At least if your study hits the media, then it's nice for the public to know what's the absolute numbers behind the results. Yeah. Thank you.